Okay, welcome everybody, and welcome to Sandbook, and you will talk about peerhood and privatization of money.
Yes. Thanks a lot for coming on this very early morning. My name is Saniva, and I've just finished my PhD degree at the IT University, and I'm now continuing there as a postdoctoral researcher at the Center for Digital Welfare. And I'm going to be talking a bit today about research for my PhD on how, the dynamics of Indonesian ride-hailing apps affect how money circulates through integrated payment platforms. And if that's a lot of very long words, don't worry, there'll be more. We'll go through them slowly. And before I start, I just want to give a big shout out to the illustrator, Nadia Rizky, who's Indonesian and who made a lot of the drawings that are in this presentation. So, would you like a top-up? So throughout my fieldwork in Indonesia, I encountered many variations of this particular question from drivers of the ride-hailing platforms called Gojek and Grab, which are equivalent to like Uber or Volt in Indonesia. And what they wanted to know was, would I be interested in purchasing some digital money for my own digital account? So in practice, it works like this. The driver and I agree on a sum of money. The driver then uses the integrated payment mechanism of the app platform, so imagine Uber, but with a separate money system, to make a digital transfer to my account, and then I give the driver cash of the equivalent amount of money. I can now use my newly topped up balance to pay the next driver digitally, rather than paying cash. And for those familiar with the more seamless digital transactions of similar ride-hailing and food delivery apps, this moment of exchange between the driver and the passenger may seem peculiar or cumbersome, so why not just pay the next driver with cash in the same way that I am de facto paying this driver cash to have a digital balance? The fact is that most people in Indonesia do not use credit or debit cards to make digital payments, and so this way, storing money as a digital credit and using a smartphone application is becoming an increasingly popular way to have digital money. Such mobile-based transactions are sometimes referred to as peer-to-peer, a concept I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with from the tech sector. And what they do in this context is allow users to transfer money digitally, directly, without using a bank. In Indonesia, the ride-hailing apps benefit from having a fleet of what's called like on-demand drivers who operate as exchange agents, like in this top-up moment. And therefore, they also operate as an extension, physically, of the entire digital payment infrastructure. Lots of long words still, it's early, we're gonna get through all of it. So, today, we're gonna talk about four things. First, we're gonna examine the concept of peer-to-peer payment. We're gonna understand what digital money means in an Indonesian context, and we're gonna talk about how hassle-free digital payment is experienced at the interface level. And finally, we're going to talk about how these apps configure consumers and drivers into very specific transactional constellations. Before we do that, I'm just going to quickly give you some context. My research is based on 6 months of fieldwork in Jogja, a city in Indonesia, which took place between 2018 and 2019, just as digital payments were becoming really popular. And so I did a lot of what's called participant observation, as well as interviews with drivers, customers, the companies, and several stakeholders. But I also started to collect screenshots, like this one, especially with when drivers that I was interviewing started sharing me their screens to try and explain how they experienced the digital economy. And so I started to begin paying attention to these app interfaces to examine how the app's design was affecting my engagement, not just with drivers, but with money itself. For example, in this screenshot, which was when this app had given me a little token to spin because I had made a transaction, and the app goes, it landed, so I spun it, and it landed on 6 points. And the app was like, hey, you know, you could have had 175 points if only you had used GoPay instead of cash. So the design of these apps is not neutral. It affects your experiences and shapes your behaviors, specifically into channeling more money through the system. At the core of my work were two of the most prominent Indonesian digital payment apps at the time, GoPay and OVO. Both gained traction as integrated payment mechanism of the respective ride-hailing platforms, Gojek and Grab. GoPay only exists as a digital wallet inside the Gojek app, so not like mobile pay here. You can only use it inside this platform. OVO operates as a standalone discount platform for an Indonesian mall franchise originally, and it also exists across multiple e-commerce platforms today. So it's kind of like a white label wallet, except they keep their wallet or the label. So through the fleets of their drivers, they have managed to convert customers of existing transport services into customers of financial services. And that's really, really critical. So let's examine the concept of a peer-to-peer transaction in more detail. And to begin, let me describe an advertisement that Gojek released for Ramadan in 2016. These are some stills from this advertisement. You see a young girl. She's asking her mother if she'll be home in time to break the fast for Ramadan. As she dons her distinctly green Gojek helmet, the mother gives her a small package, telling her to open it when she breaks the fast. We see clips of the mother driving passengers to and fro. It's hot, she's tired, all these customers are cranky and rude. Her final passenger is taking food to an orphanage for Ramadan, of course. And as she watches all these happy children, the mother smiles, despite everything. Meanwhile, her daughter opens the gift alone. It's a box of dates, and it contains a card from her mother apologizing because they can't be together. The reason, she explains in the note, is that mom needs to make sure that everyone else gets home in time to celebrate. Finally, alone on her motorcycle and having her first drink of water, the mother receives messages as customers send grateful thanks and positive ratings through the app platform. So firstly, this advertisement presents the imagined participants in the exchange as two overarching categories of user for the platform, the service provider and the service customer. Secondly, besides the green helmet, the company itself is hardly present. The app's role as an intermediator of the exchange only becomes apparent towards the end when the phone makes its first appearance. Instead, the advertisement emphasizes how these users are social equals, helping each other out in an important social, cultural, and religious event. What it does not emphasize is the precarity of the single mother who cannot be home since she must work long hours. Instead, it almost seems as if she's doing this work out of a sense of social responsibility towards her peers. Notably, money is never seen nor mentioned. The word peer itself, of course, has a very specific social meaning. And instead, it generally refers to a person or object of equal status or rank to someone or something else. And I am particularly interested in how the phrase peer-to-peer, which we know as a term from computing, came to describe an economic transaction, and how the retention of the term peer in this context imbues the expression P2P payments with certain social meaning. Firstly, various definitions of the word peer are all characterized by the critical underlying trait that being a peer is something that can only be defined in relation to something else. Secondly, all uses imply a sense of equality within the peer relation, whether it's socioeconomic or computational. Originally used to describe a non-hierarchical network topology, the phrase peer-to-peer, or P2P, is now being more commonly used outside of tech communities to describe diverse types of digital value transaction by financial technology companies. Most famous is something called M-Pesa, which is a form of mobile money that originated in Kenya, which allows users to top up their phone credits through a network of agents, send this credit to others, who can then cash it out through the same agent network. And this type of digital transaction is usually what's characterized as peer-to-peer because it allows transfer of money to each other without the use of a bank. A practice greatly valorized by the fintech industry for creating access to important financial services normally considered inaccessible to the poor or socioeconomically marginalized people. So I am particularly interested in how the phrase came to describe this economic transaction and how the retention of the term peer-to-peer retains these social meanings. And I would really love to talk more about this with you both today and later. So a peer-to-peer transaction where one person transfers a form of digital value to another. But the language of peer-to-peer is prominent within the use of commercial digital wallets and perpetuates the idea of mutual exchange in accordance with the P2P ideal of a flat, symmetrical, or egalitarian relationship without an intermediary. But this transaction to someone has to happen through something, through hardware, services, networks, app interfaces, agents, third parties, the intermediaries of the transaction. Thus, rather than interpreting the two as a numerical representation of the direction of the transaction, it might serve an analytical purpose to consider it a placeholder for the intermediaries through which the transaction travels. The apps. The simplistic representation of the directional transaction implied by the P2P acronym provides a superficial rendering of the complex exchange relationship it actually contains. It might instead be useful to understand this term as a relational acronym, where the so-called peers on either side of the exchange have their own relationship, as well as relationships to the intermediaries. The use of the phrase peer-to-peer, rather than, for instance, user-to-user, undeniably also introduces all of these implicit social meaning to the exchange relationship. In the context of P2P and network nodes, peer is used as an alternative to the hierarchical arrangement of a client and server, right? But what is the equality implied in the P2P of payments? Are they peers of equal social status? Is it that they are accessing the same resource or are presumed to have the same capacity for operating the technology? Is it within the configurations of the technology that they're defined as equal parties? Or is this peerhood one that emerges when all other aspects of their social context are removed, leaving only equality because everything but the fact of the exchange itself has been stripped away? The term P2P confuses not only these complex relational dynamics, but also obscures the power that the intermediaries thus exert in configuring the conditions of the exchange relationship of the alleged peers. In science and technology studies, we talk a lot about how the emergence of a technology must also entail the emergence of the user. So rather than being a specific person, the user is a composite character, a caricature of what kinds of actions those designing the technology imagine its future users to make. A peer is, of course, also a user of the technology, but the term peer, as we've discussed, introduces additional dimensions to the person and perhaps also requirements from the technology. If you're going to call your user a peer, what does that mean for your technology? What is it you're going to have to put into that code to make sure that there's some sort of equality in that relationship? After all, how would you configure for peerhood? So by thinking about these self-declared neutral platform companies and the configuration of users into exchange relationships, we can really begin to unpack the effect of the technology on the many P's and the many 2's within digital payments in Indonesia, which is what we'll do now. So to understand how the apps work and how they're experienced in practice, we need first to understand a few things about the existence of digital money in Indonesia. Firstly, it's important to address the fact that Indonesia has been going through massive economic growth since political and economic instability in the late 90s. But though the poverty rate has fallen, income and wealth inequality has also been growing rapidly. Presently, the richest 4 men share a combined wealth of more than the poorest million. Thus, despite economic developments, many people still do not have or use a bank account. The government has initiated multiple projects to increase what they call financial inclusion. And in 2019, they declared that over 75% of the population now had access to a bank account. A critical step, one might argue, in an overarching public policy to become what they call a less cash society. For most Indonesians, digital payment has generally meant using a debit card to make a payment at a shop or an ATM card, which, aside from making withdrawals at an ATM machine, also allows users to access their bank accounts or make transfers directly at the machine. For most people that I spoke with, the emphasis was therefore not on digital money itself, but on the ability of the ATM to transition money between being digital and tangible, as they needed it to be. Within the population that has access to a bank account, only a minority own a credit card. In fact, according to the Global Findex database, only 2.4% of the adult Indonesian population had a credit card in 2017. And for those who can pay by card, this is the type of you that might meet you in a store or cafe. This thing that the machines are standing on is called a terminal tree. It's a little structure. So despite increasing interoperability between banks and payment providers, customers using these infrastructures from banks other than their own can still face substantial fees. And so for the people who are receiving payments, it becomes critical to be able to provide for all of your customers, which is also quite expensive, and which means that those who can afford to have all of the relevant terminals can, and those who cannot, cannot. Therefore, each bank needs its own EDC terminal, as can be seen in these pictures. So, whereas digital money stored in your bank can be mobilized using a plastic card, electronic money, or e-money, was given a distinct legal definition in 2009 as a type of digital credit balance issued and stored by a private actor. E-money is issued based on the equivalent value of state-issued money deposited by a holder to the issuer, the holder being the customer, the issuer being the companies. It is stored electronically in a media such as a server or a chip. It is used as a means of payment to a merchant, which could be a shop, cafe, or of course, drivers. E-money is what apps like GoPay and OVO provide access to. It's a type of debt that GoPay or OVO issue to you and which they repay you when you use the app to pay one of their affiliated merchants, effectively by transferring your credit record to the record of the merchant, after which it can be withdrawn again as cash. While the use of e-money has been rapidly increasing these past years, as can be seen to the left, it's worth noting that despite all of the hype of like mobile-based transactions, the amount of money being transacted in this way pales in comparison to the more conventional uses of ATM or debit transactions. Just so we really manifest, hype is hype. So, when the discourse surrounding digital payments emphasizes the phrase cashless or less cash, as advocated by the Indonesian government, we obscure what it is that these cash transactions are being replaced by. As digitalization draws attention to the underlying infrastructures of money, particularly the concept of payments has received renewed academic attention. When you make a digital payment, what you're doing is requesting the entity which keeps your record of accounts to alter that record and the record of the person that you are making the payment to. This generally takes place through banks and various third-party payment processors. Thus, what happens in a cashless or less cash society is the centralization of control over payment infrastructure, where cash can be considered a public, state-issued social infrastructure. Digital payments are generally the domain of private entities. Though the money transacted through the Gojek app may be denominated in the state-issued Indonesian rupiah, the tokens are contained within and transported through their private infrastructure. Thus, these apps not only determine the price to be paid for their services, but the price of payment itself, as we will see shortly. For the intermediaries processing these digital payments, the value in providing payment infrastructure shifted with digitalization, from imposing fees or rent in exchange for the service of physically moving money, to the value of the transactional metadata itself. So when I purchase things through the Gojek app, I let the app and its owners know where I like to shop, what I like to buy, what my transport routes are, and what I am willing to spend. Where cash is anonymous and usable only by whoever is holding it, digital money becomes hyper-personalized. The digitalization of money has facilitated this unprecedented aggregation of transactional metadata. Thus, to quote economic anthropologist Bill Maurer, for intermediaries, the dream is for a system where value enters a network, circulates endlessly, never leaving as material cash. For Gojek, the self-declared goal is to become a super app, an app that provides for all of a customer's wants and needs by hosting other apps within the overarching umbrella of a single platform. As the head of the Gojek data engineering team writes on the company blog, the biggest moat Gojek ever built is payments. Once you're handling money for a user, you can build a castle of services within it. The moat, this is not his quote, this is me now. The moat is comprised of the digital credits issued privately through the GoPay wallet. Purchased using Indonesian rupiah, these GoPay credits can be used exclusively for services within the Gojek platform. Thus, It is Gojek that controls the metaphorical drawbridge, which both gives access to and confines money, services, and people within the moat boundaries. So, it's this expansion from a ride-hailing app into the center of our socio-economic exchange practices and the subsequent dynamics that these platforms introduce to the circulation of value that deserves increased scrutiny. Where cash can be exchanged from one hand to another, digital money requires a little more infrastructural support, such as QR codes or the EDC terminals we saw earlier. And much of this infrastructure is rendered invisible by design, thus allowing users to famously pay without hassle. The underlying infrastructures become concealed within these frictionless aesthetics. So let's go for a little walk inside this friction and hassle-free castle. When you open either the Gojek or Grab app, this is the home screen that greets you. In both apps, the digital wallet appears as a menu bar at the top of the screen, which shows you your balance, denominated in rupiah. The menu allows you to top up or make payments and lures you in with the promise of more features, only to reveal that you have to be a premium user to access features like withdrawing your money or sending money to other people. Thus, for regular users, money stored in the app can only exit again in the form of payment. Only through consumerism can you use this money for anything. If you want to top up your balance, the app specifically asks you to make a payment using a debit card. In other words, you are buying GoPay credits, not unlike how you would buy a gift card for a very favorite shop. And for those without a debit card or a bank account, remember, not everyone has those, the app provides very detailed instructions for a variety of alternative top-up methods. First and foremost, suggesting that you ask your driver for a top-up, which is also the only free way to do so. As a customer, the main way to interact with this digital wallet is when the app asks you to select a payment method for in-app purchases. So in these images, we see me selecting a payment method for a car booking I made in the Grab app. To the left is the price if I chose OVO, the digital credit. As I don't have enough OVO, I have to select the cash option. Noticeably, the price changes from 4 to 20,000 rupiah. The interface design also deploys color, using green to show how good and cheap the digital payment option is compared to the more neutral black used for cash. Even worse, having selected cash, a red notification bar appears at the top of the screen, reminding me that I'll be missing out on an 80% discount for not choosing OVO. Thus, the presence of the digital payment option is not presented as a convenient or neutral alternative to making a cash payment. And this is just one example of how both of these apps aggressively encourage users to pay digitally, to the point that one almost comes to feel punished for choosing cash. And this affects how people use the apps. So by 2019, I was constantly comparing discounts across apps. I found myself taking every opportunity to ensure that my accounts were topped up to avoid feeling as though I was missing out on a cheaper trip and thus wasting my money. And similarly, for most of the people I interviewed, the real value proposition of e-money was not the fact that it's digital. It's the ability of this particular form of money to give access to cheaper services and products. What the apps primarily give is an access point for the type of purchases that are associated with a middle-class life. Personal drivers, discounted food delivery, cashbacks when shopping at the mall, like this restaurant, where three different apps are encouraging you to use their particular form of payment with absolutely wild cashbacks. So how do drivers fit into this whole digital money ecosystem? So let me begin by describing one of my absolutely earliest encounters with some unexpected transactional frictions in 2018. I had just downloaded the Gojek app and I had topped up my GoPay wallet and was trying to use the money to pay for a cappuccino in a neighborhood coffee shop. "Belum bisa," a barista told me when I asked if I could pay for my order with GoPay. "You can't yet." I had selected this coffee shop from my neighborhood because I had seen it listed in the GoFood section of the Gojek app, and so I had assumed that the digital wallet would be an acceptable form of payment. "The coffee shop only accepted cash," the barista explained. "But if I wanted to use GoPay, there was a way of doing so." I could make an order for my coffee using the GoFood tab in the Gojek app and select the digital payment option rather than cash upon checkout. A driver would receive my order, drive to the cafe, place the order, wait for it to be prepared, and then pay for it using their own cash. The driver would then bring me the coffee and be paid for the cost of the coffee and his time using my GoPay balance. This was my first encounter with the entanglements of online drivers and digital money in Indonesia, and my very first confounding experience of the peculiar limitations and opportunities for transaction that have materialized just through the interfaces of these apps. When I started using these apps in 2018, I assumed that drivers and customers shared, if not the same, at least a similar type of digital wallet infrastructure. After all, I was paying with my GoPay wallet, it seemed natural to assume that they were receiving it in their GoPay wallet. In practice, drivers use a separate app entirely, and it contains three digital wallets, as can be seen in this image. There's a credit wallet, from which the company extracts their 20% cut of income on trips paid with cash. Then there's a cash wallet, used to store income from digital payments. And finally, there's a consumer wallet, GoPay for Gojek drivers and OVO for Grab drivers, to which they can then transfer their earnings directly and then use it through the consumer version of the apps, which some drivers do, meaning they can literally just put the money they've earned directly into the consumer wallet and also spend it on things. Very convenient infrastructure. For income to be useful for drivers, they have to make a request to the app to cash out their balance. The company then debits their account and transfers money to the driver's bank account. And only then can the drivers withdraw the money as cash at an ATM. Notably, this means that contrary to customers, all drivers must have a bank account to use these apps. And if they don't have one, Gojek provides them with one through their partnership with Bank Central Asia, the largest privately owned bank in Indonesia. Truly, banking the unbanked, in order for the customer to experience hassle-free and heavily discounted cashless payments. When a driver tops up a customer balance, they're selling their own digital balance and receiving cash in exchange. The apps incentivize drivers to do this, either by awarding them points, which count towards their daily bonus targets, or by giving them a digital cashback of up to 20% of what they sold. As you can see here, where the driver has received 4,000 as a bonus for completing a top-up. One driver proudly shared that he would nudge customers to buy a top-up, securing himself cashbacks of up to 100 to 150,000 per day just for selling his balance, implying sales of between 500 to 750,000 each day. Curious, I asked the driver what his strategy was for maintaining such high liquidity in his digital account. He argued that for the most part it wasn't a problem since customers were constantly replenishing his account by paying through OVO, just as I had done for this trip. Incidentally, I had just asked him for a top-up equivalent exactly to the cost of the trip itself, because, as described earlier, I too was concerned with maintaining a digital balance. I had made a 20,000 cashless payment using OVO to access a discounted trip. Then I proceeded to use the same amount of cash to replenish my digital account in preparation for my next trip. As a reward for selling his OVO balance to me, the driver later receives 4,000 rupiah as a cashback to his digital wallet. From the driver's point of view, he had received my digital payment and then sold me the exact same amount back, receiving 20,000 cash in exchange, but also receiving this digital 4,000 from the company. In total, the driver earned 24,000 rupiah, but in the process, he also managed to convert 20,000 of his existing balance into the more useful form of cash. The irony of this cash-filled cashless transaction was not lost on the driver. Uang memutar, he laughed. Money goes around. It wasn't an atypical exchange, he explained. Like me, many passengers chose to top up on each booking, opting for smaller and more frequent top-ups rather than maintaining a large digital balance. So, for drivers, selling balance to customers represents a really important alternative way to cash out, because accessing an ATM can be quite inconvenient. By selling their balance, drivers instantly convert digital assets into cash without having to wait for the transfer to be processed by the system. Meanwhile, the e-money tokens continue circulating within the system, and the company doesn't have to make any bank transfers at all. So operating on the front lines of the digital economy, these drivers are doing all of the persuasive work of bringing new customers into the digital payment ecosystem of these apps on behalf of the companies they're working for. Drivers are converted into on-the-go digital ATMs for customers, but they also use customers as an on-the-go cash ATM for themselves, because drivers need cash. And therefore, it is they who incur the hassle of having to rematerialize digital money into cash. Thus, in this system, drivers are the ones who take on the frictions, the risks, and the transaction costs of facilitating a hassle-free digital payment ecosystem. And this becomes particularly clear if we examine the moment of topping up in more detail. So these screenshots show a top-up transaction that I had with a Grab driver. Once my booking is accepted by the driver, the app covers most of the map with an unclosable splash screen with a dominating green button encouraging me to top up my balance with the driver. Fine. After clicking the button, the next screen informs me that I can request between 10 to 320,000 rupiah from the driver, and it gives me the option to enter a figure. The app now shows me this comforting image with a sparkling green check mark. My request has been successfully submitted. In the car, the driver reaches for his phone, and almost instantly a new splash screen appears on my screen, telling me that the top-up has been successful. And I hand the cash to the driver. But there are a few things that the customer does not see in this transaction. Firstly, when the app tells me how much money I can request, the number it's showing me is the entire contents of the driver's digital cash wallet. Secondly, the driver does not actually have the option to decline this transaction. In the driver version of the app, the splash screen that appears gives him simply the option to click a similar green button that reads, "Collect money." The button doesn't even say confirm transaction. Once requested by the customer, the transaction is inevitable. There's no meaningful agency here for the driver. And such design may not have any malicious intent, but it reflects neglect, revealing that the contents of a digital wallet do not truly belong to the driver until they've been withdrawn as cash. Instead, the wallet is there to enable customers to access and make use of company-issued digital credit. So, having examined how payments and digital money work in practice, let's shift our focus finally to how the apps arrange the customers and drivers, configuring them into these roles of consumer cyborg and driver partner. To begin, let's zoom out from this particular castle for a moment with its moats and examine some of the arguments perpetuated by the financial technology industry in the promotion of these products. Let me summarize these quotes that are about or from the Indonesian fintech industry. Publicly, these companies perpetually make the argument that their financial technologies will lead to financial inclusion of those who are unbanked by bringing millions of people into the digital economy as members of a cashless society. And globally, this is a really dominating narrative surrounding the type of P2P payments we're talking about. And it's an outcome of a global paradigm shift that led to perceiving the world's poor as a new and exciting market opportunity. And these arguments are frequently mobilized in favor of expanding private money services, often with support from national governments, as is the case of Gojek and the Indonesian state, which the founder of Gojek is now a member of because he's become the Minister of Culture and Education. It's presumed that by giving a poor person access to financial services or to selling their products and services on such a platform, that they'll be able to generate income and thus lift themselves out of poverty. But this ignores the complex structural dynamics that lead to socioeconomic inequalities, such as the increasing income and wealth disparities in Indonesia. And a similar logic casts ascendance to the middle class as a personal responsibility, which in turn construes being afflicted by poverty as a personal failing. And these are stigmatizing moral judgments, which lead to the legitimization of exploitation of those deemed less financially responsible or less diligent. critical thing to remember is that participation in a cashless economy is not a universal experience. A technology that makes life more convenient for some can greatly complicate the lives of others. In practice, these Indonesian apps reproduce specific ideas about consumption that are at odds with the visions of the marginalized and unbanked populations that these same actors argue that their apps will benefit. They reveal a certain positionality of both their developers, their investors, and their imagined consumers. Particularly, these visions reproduce ideas about the modern Indonesian middle-class lifestyle and the type of aspirational consumerism that can demarcate you as having these forms of social capital, as illustrated in this wonderful Gojek advertisement for their new Pay Later service. It's worth noting that a central component of how the middle class constitutes itself is through the employment of others, publicly demonstrating the forms of affluence that allow them to pay others to do things for them. Driver partners, notably, are not employed by these apps. They're mobilized in service of the customers and, by extension, the digital economy. And as I point out in my research, the loosely organized drivers were previously known as Ojek and simply existed long before there was ever Gojek. What these companies have done is impose themselves on an existing social infrastructure and provided customers with an easily interpretable interface for engagement. And in doing so, their platforms create momentary stabilizing parameters for exchange, thus controlling the conditions of transaction that were already taking place before they arrived. Proponents of the gig economy and those forms of digital capitalism often argue that this is a type of labor that makes workers more flexible, more able to exert control over their lives. But in practice, with Gojek and Grab, anyone can easily and flexibly employ a temporary servant, perpetuating what scholars like Rayan Kayum conceptualize as cultures of servitude, social relations of domination and subordination through which subsequent dependency and inequality are normalized and reproduced through these everyday social interactions. And this division in who is being served and who is doing the serving is most eloquently expressed by Gojek's founder, Nadiem Makarim himself. During a 2019 fireside chat at an industry event in Bali, Makarim makes a really interesting observation about the app he helped create, calling Gojek the operating system of the real world. Makarim elaborates, "You're creating a cyborg in our consumers that are able to not have to do the things they don't want to do and therefore have more time to get stuff done in life." Implicit here is the logic of automation, which reduces time being spent on a process. Through this automation, the app, the phone, and the driver who's tasked with doing those things for you all become part of your extended cyborg self. It's interesting that the emphasis here is on how the app can serve those similar to Makarim himself. His emphasis on productivity, efficiency, on not having to waste your time when someone else can waste theirs for you, feels remarkably revealing of his worldview and his orientation of one of the app's consumer cyborgs. In characterizing what problem he feels Gojek is trying to solve in the world, Makarim says, "It was simply a problem of mobility, right? How do you get a human, an object, like food or money or value, to move in the fastest possible, cheapest, most convenient way using one tool?" His answer is the app. But the app does not result in the rapid, cheap, and convenient circulation of people, objects, and value. That circulation is facilitated by the human labor performed by the driver partners. So when Makarim uses language such as cyborg or operating system of the world, he foregrounds the technological innovation and reinforces the idea of seamless automated processes by which this circulation takes place almost magically. And Gojek and Grab are not the only companies that refer to their fleets of drivers as driver partner, a title that demarcates a different type of relationship than someone employed to work for the company. It was not uncommon for drivers to express their discontent with these conditions of the alleged partnership. They were partners with the app company who relied on each other for income, yet they were not equal parties. When drivers sign up, they accept the terms and conditions that come with working as an online driver. However, as many have pointed out, those conditions frequently change without warning or consultation with the drivers. There's no two-way negotiation. They experience that the apps define them as on-demand robots, their labor mobilized and channeled through the app infrastructure to serve the need of the consumer cyborgs, and ultimately, the financial interests of the companies. So as one driver responded when I asked him what word he would use instead of driver partner, servant, Probably. In practice, the social relationships, the alleged transactional peerhood of these apps is heavily mediated by algorithms, which lead to the formation of new transactional hierarchies. In the final chapter of my thesis, I go into great detail to document how drivers experience being mobilized as on-demand servants through these platforms. I'll touch on just a few here because time. Firstly, driver income is calculated by a set kilometer tariff, which does not include distance to the customer or time spent in traffic. This is supplemented by a daily bonus from the companies. Drivers earn points for each completed trip, hoping to reach the highest of three tiers to reach the maximum bonus. Critically, drivers do not receive this bonus if they cancel more than 25% of trips. Though they may have good reasons for doing so, falling below the euphemistically titled productivity rating means that they incur what's called a debt trip, meaning that they must complete more orders in order to bring the productivity rating up while the company holds their bonus hostage. Meanwhile, customers are encouraged to rate their experience after each trip. So for the customer point of view, rating a driver between 1 to 5 stars is a question of a few millimeters and a thumb swipe. For drivers, this transaction is a source of constant anxiety because less than 5 stars will ruin their algorithmic ranking. And many offer customers drinks or snacks or engage in other forms of relational work as a way to ensure these good ratings. In a worst-case scenario, a customer might give a driver a 1-star rating, leading to automatic suspension. For drivers, this can be a temporary or permanent loss of income. But critically, some drivers also pointed out how it affects their access to the digital wallets and their savings, which of course are also controlled by the app which employs them. And access to digital wallets of the app is further complicated for those drivers who rely on third-party account vendors to register outside of the formal Gojek system. I first became aware of vendors when drivers would decline selling me their balance, saying there was no money, because they were with a vendor. And what I came to realize is that vendors manage fleets of drivers with the using an app infrastructure provided by Gojek. And digital earnings made by the drivers have to be manually transferred to the driver's bank account each day by the vendor. According to two employees of a vendor that I interviewed, Gojek provides them with a window for transfers through Monday and Friday between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. With an estimated 250 active drivers requiring daily transfers within a 5-hour window, the two employees only have about 2.5 minutes each per driver. So mistakes are pretty frequent. And as they transfer these daily earnings, they make sure to withdraw their own 5% cut of these earnings, of course. So there's this hierarchical difference, not just in income, but also access to and control over earnings between those drivers who are registered directly with Gojek and those who rely on the additional intermediation of vendors. More critically, in March 2019, Gojek codified a system of unequal pay. As go-car drivers woke up to an in-app notification of a change to the incentive bonus system, which radically worsened their conditions for labor. Gojek replaced the standard 3-tier bonus scale with a system using 4 different scales, known as schemas A, B, C, and D. Briefly, schema A required fewer points and therefore fewer completed trips per tier, but also reduced the maximum bonus they could earn, whereas schema D required more points but gave the highest maximum bonus. Which schema each driver is assigned was determined by how many trips they had completed in the past 2 weeks, meaning taking days away from driving could affect your income for several weeks in the future. Some drivers speculated that other performance indicators such as customer ratings, order cancellation, or even how much they turned apps on or off might also affect these algorithms. The result is that drivers experience that the value of their labor fluctuates depending on what schema they've been assigned. Even if two drivers both complete 20 trips, driver A will only receive the reward for 10 points. They will not be compensated equally for the same work. These changes to the schema were a really prominent part of my discussions with drivers in 2019, and notably, some drivers, despite their own exasperations and frustrations with the system, would differentiate schema A as being for lazy drivers and schema D for drivers who were diligent. Thus, they were also reproducing these moral judgments that legitimize the exploitation of the poor in service of the middle class. So to summarize, the idea of P2P payments leverages the social meaning and positive connotations of social equality associated with the word peer. obscuring underlying power asymmetries between the exchanging parties, as well as the power that these companies exert as they define the conditions for exchange within the digital infrastructure. Furthermore, the socially acceptable concept of peer-to-peer ultimately conceals the fact that this constellation is a transactional arrangement that is valuable to the corporation. Users of the apps, no matter if they're drivers or customers, are tools for the platforms because their transactions lead to the circulation of both money and data, which is where profits are derived. Thus, for the companies, the emphasis is not on creating equal conditions for exchange, but on securing continued customer engagement. And this is done by providing cheap and convenient services through the platform, which depends upon the exploitation of labor and the displacement of transaction costs of the digital payment onto drivers. And this exploitation and extraction of value from transactional metadata are what is camouflaged in the language of P2P and financial inclusion. Companies such as Gojek and Grab continue to receive a lot of attention for how they are revolutionizing the economy through digital technology and how they are automating existing systems and empowering drivers by formalizing their service. Meanwhile, they're growing into super apps, hoping to be the main gateway for accessing and paying for services in Indonesia and neighboring countries in Southeast Asia. They have attracted a massive amount of international venture capital from those wanting to be a part of or beneficiary of this digital transition, as the companies extend their monopolization of customers and transactional metadata. A few months ago, Gojek announced a merger with another Indonesian e-commerce company called Tokopedia. They formed the rather on-the-nose consortium called GoTo. Their stated goal is to be publicly listed on the stock exchanges in both Indonesia and the US, with an estimated value of up to $40 billion. Meanwhile, in Jogja, drivers are chasing points late into the night, stressing about managing their digital balances and worrying that customers might report them for driving a borrowed account. So Gojek and Grab may argue that their digital technologies will alleviate these problems and provide the poor and disadvantaged with alternatives to conventional financial services. In practice, however, as the companies chase profits and market monopolization, the structure of this money system reinforces socioeconomic hierarchies and attempts to further enclose people within the moat of digital payments. Thank you.
Thank you, Sonima. Any questions?
Seems there's a lot of value within these companies, and we've seen a lot of other hacks around the world of Bitcoin exchanges, which this is, has a bit of similarity to, and it seems to be easier to break into their systems and perhaps inflate it or give all the drivers a bonus. Has that happened or?
No.
Is it possible to imagine a digital payment system that does not have this kind of exploitation, or are we doomed to forever have exploitation be an intrinsic part of digital payments, and should we just all go back to cash and never use technology again?
Are we doomed? Maybe. No, I mean, I don't think that there is like a deterministic outcome here. Like, digital payments doesn't have to be negative. I think what's really important is to focus on what the people are saying as well, right? That the emphasis here is not on something being digital or being cash, it's about the ability to flexibly transition according to what suits your needs. And so, from a designer point of view, the purpose is to serve those needs, right? To create that flexible system that enables people to have the type of, or money form that they actually need. What's the issue with these kind of apps is the way that they decidedly are not neutral in the way that they, like, don't just model existing transaction, but actually engineer forms of transactions, right? So of course you could design something different. Whether or not you can change what has already been made, I think is more complicated.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to hear such a brilliant talk. I would like to ask if you're seeing in the Danish context something that resembles this peer-to-peer philosophy anywhere.
It's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of the narratives around financial inclusion, those kind of things, that's a type of hype that also exists in Danish companies, for sure. A lot of the advocacy about how these kind of payment systems will make our lives easier and more convenient also obscure like the fundamental fact that we're opting into a private transactional infrastructure. And the way that those things are often being promoted as being a better alternative to cash, I think is almost malignant, to be honest. I also think something that hasn't quite happened here, right, because in Indonesia you don't have credit cards, you can't have a system like mobile pay. But that doesn't mean that companies like Vault or Uber and these kind of things are not going to start introducing similar systems. And it would be super interesting to know more about how money actually exists within a system like Vault. For example, if you pay for something and they can't deliver, so they kind of give you a, you know, money to store in that system. I would love to find out more about how that actually works in practice. Yeah.
Have the government interfered in any way or any larger?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the National Bank has a national less cash movement. So the interference is definitely in favor of these companies. Absolutely. I mean, originally when Gojek started, there was a massive, like, the government actually tried to shut them down. But there was such a mobilization, like a million drivers protested. And so they simply had to allow it to exist. And the reality is that there are really close ties, right, politically between these CEOs and the political class. Like I said, the founder is a minister now. And so are a lot of other, actually, the new president, or the president who was re-elected in 2019 brought in a bunch of young tech people, like startup people, to come and be a part of his cabinet. They're really going to do it. It's going to be a digital country, for sure. It's great.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming.